LL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Both the Pentagon and the Congress are now looking into charges that American soldiers abused Iraqis being held at the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad. General Antonio Taguba, who was appointed to investigate the allegations, has said that they were the willful actions of a small group of soldiers. He did also say that there was a failure of leadership, ultimately responsible. However, some of those accused say that they were simply doing what they were told. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about international law and the treatment of prisoners. It is the first of what I expect to be many programs that will touch on this one way or another. And this morning, as our guest, we have Marjorie Cohen. She's professor of law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. That's in San Diego. There she teaches courses in criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and international human rights law. She's the co-author of a book titled Cameras in the Courtroom, Television in the Pursuit of Justice. She's written a number of articles about human rights, U.S. foreign policy, and criminal justice for both the popular and the academic press. She's a news consultant for CBS News, a legal analyst for Court TV. She's also appeared on the BBC, CNN, NPR. She is executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild, co-chair of the Guild's International Committee, and was recently elected the U.S. representative to the American Association of Jurists. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. I do want to mention that we did have another guest scheduled to join us. We were going to be talking with Wayne Madsen. He is an investigative journalist and columnist, former intelligence officer with the National Security Agency. And we were not, before the program, when we were getting things set up, we were not able to get in touch with him. We may be able to do that and then bring him into the program. If not, we can also always think about having him on another day. I'm sure we'll have a good conversation here with Professor Cohen. And questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone is welcome to call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. It's 800-222-9455. Professor Cohen, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing fine.
We appreciate very much you giving us your time. I thought the way we might begin is to talk about what sort of international agreements there are that specify how prisoners of war are to be treated.
There is the Third Geneva Convention, which is a treaty ratified by the United States and therefore part of the supreme law of the land under the Constitution. And that Geneva, there are four different Geneva Conventions. That particular one prescribes the treatment for prisoners of war and says they must be treated humanely. Coercion cannot be used to make them produce information. They can't be held up to public ridicule, etc. Then there's the Fourth Geneva Convention, which protects civilians in time of war, so that even if prisoners were not considered to be prisoners of war because they didn't fall under the Third Geneva Convention, they weren't wearing uniforms or insignias and other criteria, they would still be protected as civilians in time of war. And the Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits the use of physical or moral coercion to obtain information or confessions from anyone. So regardless of whether the prisoners at Abu Ghraib or Afghanistan or Guantanamo are prisoners of war, they should still be protected against being treated inhumanely and against being coerced into providing information under the Fourth Geneva Convention. And evidently Donald Rumsfeld has not read that particular Geneva Convention.
Well, this seems to be an important point, and one where there seems to be some confusion. First of all, Secretary Rumsfeld has said, according to what I have read, that he feels that as far as those people who are being held in Iraq, that he does consider the Geneva Convention applies to them. He said that as far as those people were concerned in Afghanistan and in Guantanamo, that it doesn't. And there have been complaints of similar activities going on in Guantanamo and in Afghanistan. But as far as it sounds, what you're saying was it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you label these people, whether they were soldiers or not. Anybody should be covered by the Geneva Convention.
Yes, it's clear that under the Fourth Geneva Convention, civilians are covered, and if they're not prisoners of war, they're civilians. Donald Rumsfeld has taken it upon himself to decide that they're not prisoners of war, whereas the Geneva Convention, the Third Geneva Convention, the one on POWs, says that that if there is a doubt whether or not prisoners are prisoners of war, that a competent tribunal should determine that. And Rumsfeld has decided he's the competent tribunal to determine that. So now that all of these pictures are coming out and the horrific images are coming out from Iraq, he's waving the Geneva Conventions around, yet under his command, and ultimately, of course, I guess Bush is the commander-in-chief, but Rumsfeld is the next down. The Geneva Conventions were not published. They were not used to train the interrogators and the guards at the Abu Ghraib prison. They weren't anywhere in sight. So Donald Rumsfeld can talk about how they apply, but they were not being used properly when they should have been used. And I heard this morning that Donald Rumsfeld, who is at Abu Ghraib prison as we speak, visiting, said that he would like the remaining images, the remaining photographs and videos, to be released to the public, but his lawyers have told him that it would violate the Geneva Conventions. Rumsfeld uses the Geneva Conventions when it suits his purpose.
There is also apparently another international convention, one against torture, that is never permitted under any circumstances, even in war, and that this, like the Geneva Convention, is a convention that the United States has ratified, so we're bound to comply with it.
Absolutely. You're speaking about the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, and that has been ratified by the United States, and again, it is part of our domestic law. It's not some abstract law out in the stratosphere. It does apply to us. And it says torture is never permitted, even in times of war or national emergency. And the definition of torture under that convention is when a public official or one acting in an official capacity intentionally inflicts, instigates, or consents to the infliction of severe pain or suffering on a person for the purpose of obtaining information or a confession. And many of the abuses that we have seen in the Taguba report, chronicled in Major General Antonio Taguba's report on the Abu Ghraib prison, qualify as torture.
So that, again, an important point there, because when you read some of the stories about the activities that were undertaken and about what the military thought that it could or could not do, you get this impression that it's a fine line between what's permitted and what's not. At least as far as you're concerned, what you have seen described in the media about what went on at Abu Ghraib and perhaps also in Guantanamo and in Afghanistan, as far as you're concerned, in your mind, there would be no question that qualifies. The secretary said the other day when he was testifying, I believe, in the Senate, that he thought perhaps some of this did qualify as abuse, but wasn't sure whether he thought it would qualify as torture. As far as you're concerned, it is torture.
Well, some of it is. Some of it's inhuman treatment. Rumsfeld told reporters last week when he was trying to put a lid on this growing scandal, he said, "My impression is that what has been charged thus far is abuse, which I believe technically is different from torture." He evidently at that point had not heard of the sodomizing of one of the detainees with a chemical light and perhaps a broomstick. This is chronicled in the Taguba report. Putting the naked detainee on a box with a sandbag on his head and attaching wires to his fingers, toes, and penis and threatening him with electric torture. I'm reading right out of the Taguba report. And using military dogs without muzzles who then biting and severely injuring a detainee. Those, in my opinion, would qualify as torture under the definition from the Torture Convention. But even if you want to say they're not torture, and Rumsfeld did admit when he was testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Friday that some of the photographs that he saw that hadn't been made public depicted sadistic, cruel, and inhuman behavior. Under the Geneva Convention, torture and inhuman treatment are considered grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, and grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions are considered war crimes. So whether you want to call it torture or whether you want to call it inhuman treatment, we're talking about war crimes. And there are federal laws that provide for life imprisonment or the death penalty if the victim dies for the commission of war crimes.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'll get to them and bring them into the conversation, but also I want to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're speaking with Marjorie Cohen. She is professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law, that's in San Diego, where, among other things, she teaches international human rights law. And we're talking here about the current scandal about the abuse of Iraqis in Abu Ghraib and perhaps elsewhere. Questions and comments certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have two callers here ready to go. The first is in Philo. We'll start there. Line number one. Hello. Go ahead.
Yes. Words fail me. I think that this whole scandal has brought shame on us as Americans and in this country for what Rumsfeld and I think you have to start at the top Bush has done with this policy. And I think it was a policy, and I'd like you to comment on the pictures. And the reason I say that is because if you look at those pictures and the people smiling in them and everything, they didn't believe they were doing anything wrong. They say they were ordered to do it. And, you know, how far up does it go? And I'd just like to hear your comments. And thank you very much, David, for having this program on today.
Sure. Well, Professor Cohen, what do you think?
Yes, I think the caller raises a very good point, and that is that the images depicted in the pictures and the fact that the soldiers seem to be proud of what they're doing and the fact that there are so many pictures means that they were not hiding anything from their superiors. They believed that they were doing the right thing. And Lindy England, who is now mounting a defense to criminal charges that have been filed against her, is saying that she was told to pose and smile for those pictures. I don't know if that's true or not, and presumably that will come out in court. But the one of the interesting things here is that in addition to the report of General Taguba, the International Committee for the Red Cross also made a report about this prison and others in Iraq and really confirmed many of the allegations in the Taguba report, also found systemic abuse of the security detainees at Abu Ghraib. And the Red Cross characterized some of the interrogation tactics as tantamount to torture. One of the most shocking things about the Red Cross report is that it says that 70 to 90% of the detainees in Iraq were arrested by mistake. And that's quite alarming. But another thing the Red Cross said, and this goes directly to the question of the caller, is that the physical and psychological coercion, and that's their words, by the interrogators appeared to be part of the standard operating procedures used by the military intelligence personnel. And this could, if you look at, you know, it's on television all the time, and so many people standing around in these pictures, and I don't know if they're all military people or some of them might be the mercenaries. They're called civilian contractors, but they are mercenaries getting thousands of dollars for being there, not being subject to any military law. the commanders, the people in charge of the prison, must have known. They must have known about this. There's another thing that connects this to a policy, and when we're talking about holding the commanders liable under the doctrine of command responsibility, which is a very well-established doctrine that says that if a commander knew or should have known that illegal activity was taking place and failed to prevent or stop it, that he is just as liable. And this is on the front page of the New York Times, and it's also, but it came out in my article last night on truthout.org, and I got it straight out of the Taguba report, which is that Major General Jeffrey Miller, who was the commander of the Guantanamo prison and in charge of the interrogations there, was sent to Iraq late last year to review the, and the Taguba report says, the current Iraqi theater ability to rapidly exploit internees for actionable intelligence. And the Taguba report says that Miller used the Guantanamo interrogation procedures as baselines. So here's the connection between Guantanamo and Iraq, and prisoners released from Guantanamo have reported torture there. One prisoner told Amnesty International that the interrogations, quote, were like torture, unquote. And an Australian lawyer, Richard Burke, reported on ABC Radio that one of the Guantanamo detainees had described being taken out and tied to a post and having rubber bullets fired at them, and they were being made to kneel cruciform in the sun until they collapsed. So there's a connection there, and there's also a connection when Donald Rumsfeld made it very clear that he didn't think that the Geneva Conventions applied to the prisoners in Guantanamo and Afghanistan. But that sent a message to future Iraqi interrogators that anything goes. There's also been torture used in Afghanistan. There was a report in yesterday's New York Times, and in addition, in December of 2002, there was a German documentary which was aired called Massacre in Afghanistan. It was broadcast on German television, and in that documentary, an Afghan soldier was ordered by an American commander to fire shots into the closed containers that transported the prisoners. And some died from suffocation, and others, he said, were dumped in the desert, shot, and left to be eaten by dogs as American soldiers looked on. After that documentary aired, the Washington Post reported that stress and duress tactics were being used on prisoners being interrogated at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. That's the U.S. Air Base. And the U.S. military has admitted that two prisoners have been victims of homicide at the Bagram Air Base. So I think it's, and the Red Cross report also documents abuse verging on torture, really, in other prisons in Iraq. So we're not just talking about an isolated thing here where seven low-ranking soldiers had some fun at the expense of some Iraqi prisoners at Abu Ghraib. There's another thing, too, that George Tenet, CIA Director George Tenet, admitted to the 9/11 Commission when he testified, and that is that the CIA engages in what is called rendition, which is a practice of sending prisoners to other countries where torture is a stated policy to be interrogated. And many times the CIA agents go along with them and are present while they're being tortured in places like Jordan and Morocco and Saudi Arabia and Uzbekistan. rendition violates international law. It violates the Torture Convention, and under the Torture Convention, even if you don't carry out the torture yourself, you can be liable for torture if the policy is coming from the top. So I think yes, we're talking about policy. We're talking about holding the highest officials of our government liable for this. And just as after the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, which was where 300 to 500 unarmed old men, women, and children were killed, and many women raped in a little village called My Lai, and that was covered up for a long time by the government, including by Colin Powell at the time. But ultimately, when Seymour Hersh broke the story, and of course he's revealed a lot of the abuses at Abu Ghraib as well. There was a prosecution of a lieutenant, William Kelly, and he was convicted of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment and released 3 years later. But there was a lot of criticism at the time that he was the fall guy, that he was taking the rap for the higher-ups who were not prosecuted and who certainly were party to what happened and aware of it and very much in charge of it. And that's what we have to avoid this time. We have to hold our leaders accountable. And the other point the caller makes is a very good one, and that is that this has really damaged the reputation of the American people in the eyes of the world, and the overwhelming majority of American people are not like this. Most people are outraged by this. And we have to make sure that we show the world and show ourselves and show those poor Iraqis who have been treated that way. Nobody should be treated that way. Nobody. That we're going to hold them our leaders accountable.
Mm-hmm. Right. We have some other callers here. Next is someone in Champaign. So this is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I was hoping maybe you could speak a little bit more about the problematic issue of releasing more of the pictures. They talked about, for example, women having to bare their breasts. And it seems to me that even if their faces are blocked out, this would dishonor anonymous Iraqi women. In a sense, this could be seen perhaps in that culture as tantamount to rape in and of itself, and it would be a further continuation of the inhumane treatment. Or it could be kind of slipped over, and there's a kind of substitution. I do some research on this, in which it would be seen as the rape of the nation or the rape of the Ummah, of the Islamic community, and therefore becomes, you know, a great propaganda tool, which is one of the fears. But aside from the fact of fearing the, you know, possible consequences of revealing those pictures, you know, politically or whatever, does it really follow Geneva Conventions? On the one hand, if one were to do a kind of a Nuremberg-type investigation, you want to have all the evidence, but I don't know whether it has to be released to the whole world public or whether it can be.
You know, you raise a really good point, and under the Third Geneva Convention, it's prohibited to hold up, to humiliate or hold up prisoners of war to ridicule, and certainly it is very humiliating. In fact, I have read an account of at least one of the Iraqi prisoners whose face was not shown, but his genitals were shown when he was in one of the pictures naked. We've seen the pictures with the genitals blocked out, but evidently they haven't been in other parts of the world. And he said he couldn't go back to his village because he was so humiliated, even though people hadn't seen his face. So that is, it's a real danger, because on the one hand, very important that the American people know the extent of what happened, so that people can understand the scope of this torture and this inhuman treatment, and we have a right to know what our government is doing in our name. But on the other hand, releasing some of these images are going to be very humiliating and damaging to the Iraqi people. One way that this might be dealt with is to have perhaps neutral people such as the Red Cross or Human Rights Watch, human rights organizations, themselves view all the pictures and videotapes and write down a very detailed description of what they depict and release that. And then people know exactly what's in the pictures and the videotapes, and they don't have to guess. And, of course, seeing them would be much worse, and we know that because when we see, even the pictures we've seen, we're horrified. But that may be a middle ground. I'm kind of two minds on this, because I think that these things should not be, the abuses and the torture should not be hidden from the American people. I mean, we already have a few of the Republican senators coming out and saying, you know, this is no big deal. It's just like, I think some journalists actually have said, if you want to call Rush Limbaugh a journalist, and I think he was the one who said it, I may be wrong about that, that this was no worse than fraternity initiation. Of course, people choose to be in fraternities. But we had some senators who said, you know, they're more outraged at the outrage than they are at the pictures. And then this horrific, horrific, unspeakable beheading of Nick Berg, which is just an outrage. But unfortunately, what's happening is that a number of the Republicans are using that as a way to deflect the attention away from the torture that's happened at Abu Ghraib prison. And so I think it's very important to keep a perspective and to understand what's going on and to be honest about it and to take it head on and to punish people who are responsible all the way up the chain of command. But I think that the picture that the the issue you raise, the concern you raise about releasing the pictures and the videotapes is very well taken.
I have a book in front of me called Imperial Leather, Race, Gender, and Sexuality in the Colonial Contest by Anne McClintock. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about how patriarchal sex gender roles could be exploited in humiliation, domination, or torture, whether it's by Nazis or the French in Algeria, Saddam Hussein, or in the School of the Americas. Why would people engage in this? Why is this just not a fraternity prank?
Well, you know, it's there are many ways to humiliate people, and you know, I'm not an expert on torture, but there are many ways to humiliate people. But when you start to humiliate them sexually, you really move to another level. You move to the level described in the Fourth Geneva Convention as moral coercion. Those words are very clear. That moral coercion cannot be used as a way to get information or confessions from people. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about moral coercion. I mean, certainly rape involves physical coercion as well. But making people masturbate and piling people up on top of each other so their genitals touch another man's buttocks, this is moral coercion, and it's also humiliation taken to a very, very high level. And yes, that has been used. It was used by the Nazis. It's been used in many instances, and certainly in Vietnam, it was rape was used. It's just an absolutely horrific practice, and one that must be denounced, roundly denounced, and not just denounced, but really punished. We have war crimes statutes on the books. We don't have to go to the International Criminal Court because Bush has prevented us from doing that. And I think for this very reason, I think he didn't want to be a defendant in a war crimes prosecution. He didn't want Rumsfeld to be a defendant. And that's why he fought the International Criminal Court, where, you know, nearly all of the nations of the world have signed on to that court. But there are federal statutes, war crime statutes and statutes against torture, which provide for very, very stiff penalties in this country. And people should be prosecuted. And not just, you know, one of the things that we haven't spoken about is that I've mentioned it briefly, but these seven soldiers are being prosecuted criminally under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They're not being prosecuted under the War Crimes Act or the Torture Act. But none of the mercenaries, many of whom are implicated in this torture and inhuman treatment, none of them can be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice because they don't come under it. So they have to be prosecuted under these civilian laws. And, of course, military can be prosecuted under the civilian laws as well. And they should be. And evidently some of these mercenaries are still on the job doing the interrogations, and that's very frightening. There's another possible route that victims of this torture, abuse, sexual humiliation can pursue, and that's a civil remedy for damages under the Alien Tort Claims Act in the United States. And that particular act has been used by many people in other countries, such as Ecuador and Nigeria and Burma, to hold American corporations liable for torture and abuse and murder and disappearances and destroying the environment through drilling, oil drilling. And many of those cases are still pending. The problem is that the future of the Alien Tort Claims Act is now rests in the Supreme Court, and we don't know what they will do with it. And hopefully when they see what's happening in Iraq, in this prison and elsewhere, they will not say that that law, which dates back to 1789, is no longer good. But it would be great if many of these victims of this torture and inhuman treatment could actually get some monetary relief. And, of course, that would not restore their honor. Money would not do that, but it would give them some relief under the Alien Tort Claims Act.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I have some other callers. I hope the last caller will forgive me for wanting to go on and give some other folks a chance. And also for anybody who's tuned in last a little bit here, I should also introduce again our guest. Marjorie Cohen is professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law. That's in San Diego. She teaches a number of courses, including international human rights law. She is co-author of a book entitled Cameras in the Courtroom, Television and the Pursuit of Justice. She's written a number of articles about human rights, U.S. foreign policy, and criminal justice, both for the popular and the academic press. She is a news consultant for CBS News, a legal analyst for Court TV, and also has appeared on BBC and CNN and NPR and MSNBC, where she provides legal and political commentary. We're talking this morning about growing scandal, the prisoner abuse scandal involving American soldiers and private contractors in Iraq. I do also want to mention that we were not able to make contact with the other guest that we had scheduled for the program, Wayne Madsen, investigative journalist and columnist. We'll see if we can have him on another day. I'm sure that this story is not going to go away, and we will be talking about it again. But for the moment, we'll continue talking with our guest, Professor Marjorie Cohen, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on a cell phone. Been very patient. We'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
This is a very cold and clinical discussion of a very distasteful subject, and it's sad that we have to be having it, but here we are. And I was wondering if your guest could talk about the use of the pictures as a form of humiliation. I'd heard something about it. I didn't know if it was anything she heard about. And then my second question was that I had read somewhere, and I was wondering if your guest could verify or denounce this, I don't know, that Rumsfeld was quite tightly involved with the treatment of the Guantanamo prisoners, and he was very involved in determining what interrogation methods were going to be used, how they were going to be housed. And so his contention that there was just these things happening out there that he wasn't aware of in the face of this kind of history doesn't stand up very well. I was just wondering if your guest could comment on those things. Thanks.
Okay.
Yes. First of all, yes, the pictures is humiliation. I mean, the fact that it wasn't just some people taking some of these soldiers taking souvenir snapshots, but that they were actually told to pose these people in humiliating positions and then photograph them. And the photographing would be further humiliation. So I agree that the pictures, the taking of the pictures, was part of the humiliating treatment. And then, of course, the release of the photographs is another issue that we just addressed with the last caller. In terms of Rumsfeld's involvement, yes, that is true. The Washington Post, I believe it was, documented that Rumsfeld had to sign on to 20 of the most egregious interrogation techniques at Guantanamo. Involvement was all the way to the top. So yes, that's true. There is involvement, hands-on involvement there in terms of approving interrogation policies. Then Rumsfeld can't say, well, I had no idea what was going on, and I'm just appalled, and I just thought that they were, following the Geneva Convention. So, no, Rumsfeld is very, very heavily involved. And another thing that's important to keep in mind is that there's a very influential newspaper called the Army Times. This is not some left-wing publication. And the Army Times implicates both General Richard Myers, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Rumsfeld in the Iraqi prison scandal. And it states that the responsibility, quote, extends all the way up the chain of command to the highest reaches of the military hierarchy and its civilian leadership, unquote. And then the Army Times, and this is very, very serious, the Army Times says, quote, this was not just a failure of leadership at the local command level, this was a failure that ran straight to the top. Accountability here is essential, even if it means relieving top leaders from duty in a time of war. So this is really tantamount to calling for Rumsfeld's resignation. And I think, of course, it's going to be totally political about whether or not Rumsfeld steps down or Bush lets him go. And in some ways, it might be a test of who's really running the White House, and which I think is Dick Cheney. And I think that Rumsfeld is key to the neoconservatives' agenda. He is the linchpin of their Iraq policy, and I don't think they can afford to lose him. On the other hand, if Bush is listening to a higher power, which he claims helps him make most of his decisions, he may decide, and Karl Rove is also someone that he listens to. Karl Rove is running his campaign, his election campaign. He may decide that it's too much of a political liability to keep Rumsfeld, and it'll be very interesting to see whether Rumsfeld survives. Bush came out, not the last time he spoke, but the time before, and said that Rumsfeld will stay in my cabinet. That means that maybe he could reassign him to another position in his cabinet. And Senator Ted Kennedy made a very interesting suggestion that Colin Powell take over as Secretary of Defense. He says Colin Powell knows how to win a war. And I'm not sure that the people who are controlling Bush would actually allow that, because they have had a lot of struggles with Colin Powell, who's been more of a moderating influence. He has certainly saluted and marched like a good soldier, ultimately defending the administration's policy, but behind the scenes he has evidently complained vigorously, and that's documented in Bob Woodward's book and elsewhere. So it will be very interesting to see what happens politically. That's different from what should happen legally and morally. And in my opinion, what should happen legally and morally is that regardless of how high up it goes, they must be held accountable. And that means that Rumsfeld should not just be asked to resign. War crimes investigations should be initiated against Rumsfeld as well, in my opinion.
I have some other people here, and I want to get some other questions, but I wonder if I could ask you quickly a kind of a legal question, and it goes back to the issue of responsibility. As we have said, some of the people who were charged with abuse have said that what they were doing was with the approval of their superiors, and for example, this young woman, Lindy England, said that, she was the person who is now in the photograph that has been so reproduced that it was so upsetting, with the Iraqi, naked Iraqi man lying on the floor with the leash, collar around his neck, and she's standing there holding a leash. And she apparently said that specifically that was that photograph, the pose and the picture, had been the result of direct orders. Now, if what we were talking about here were war crimes, that kind of defense doesn't wash. But if what we're talking about is she's being charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, then can she use the fact that she was ordered, if indeed that she was ordered to do something, can she use that as a defense?
No, she can't use "I was just following orders" as a defense under the Uniform Code of Military Justice either, if she was being given an order that was illegal. There is a duty to disobey an illegal order. Lieutenant William Calley tried that defense, "I was just following orders," when he was charged with murder from the My Lai massacre, and that defense did not fly. It didn't fly at Nuremberg, and it wouldn't fly here as well.
All right. Well, we have some other callers, and we'll continue. The next in line is Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Good morning. Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Okay. I had two questions. Yesterday in the hearing, the morning hearings, I guess it was a senator from Hawaii asked about contractors, and also third country people were present, and the contractors, you implied, could be done either by international law, could be tried, held accountable. I assume that would apply for third country, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. That's one thing, is where they would come down, or would it have to go, if they're a military from another country, would it have to go through, would the U.S. be inclined to let them do it in their own court or something? I'm not sure if it could be. It seems to me it's kind of pie in the sky. But the other question I had is that we're talking about the pictures and the sexual humiliation, and it gets diminished as a prank, but there was actual real torture, and I guess some of the films yesterday, it's kind of I don't know how to call it. We have the snuff film put up by the people in Iraq, but there's some suggestion that there was actually some kind of documentation of a death in the videos that were released, and that's the kind of speculation is going to happen if they don't release them. But I've also heard about 20 deaths and two prosecutions, and I think that 12 of the deaths at Gareb were by snipers. And I've been looking a little bit this morning just trying to figure out who's covering what that part of the story is, and I was wondering if you knew about that. And the scenario that I've developed in my head about explaining how you would have sniper deaths at a prison is that there was, the people were let out in the yard or something, and they wouldn't return. There was a revolt in the prison, and they shot people from above. Do you know anything about that?
Well, starting with your first question, the mercenaries who are U.S. citizens can be tried under U.S. law, under the War Crimes Act or the Torture Act. People who are not U.S. citizens could be, if their country has ratified the International Criminal Court, could be tried in the International Criminal Court or under principles of universal jurisdiction by any country. Adolf Eichmann was tried in Israel for his crimes during the Holocaust in Germany, even though Israel didn't have any direct connection with what he did, with his atrocities. They tried him, convicted him, and executed him. And the principle of universal jurisdiction is a very well-settled principle. Or they could be tried in their own courts, in their own countries. And I know that a number of these mercenaries are not U.S. Nationals, and so that is a problem. And you're right that if the pictures and the videos are not released, there's going to be speculation, and that's why I would suggest that neutral human rights organizations such as the International Committee of the Red Cross, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, be allowed to view all the pictures and videotapes and then describe them in detail and release a report. I think that's one way to get around it. I, too, had heard the number of 20 deaths from the Abu Ghraib prison and two prosecutions. In terms of the snipers, in the I believe it was either the Taguba report or the Red Cross report, I can't remember which, it described shootings of people who were revolting or escaping, and that may or may not amount to excessive force depending upon what the situation was, but the way to it is not a proper method of capture to be shooting somebody in the back who's trying to escape, shooting them dead. In terms of any more details on prosecutions, I don't have any more information than you do.
I would presume that the place is fairly secure, and that the scenario I had in my head was that people just didn't come in, and they were summarily shot as a sort of a demonstration. Now maybe I'm too inclined, but again, if that isn't talked about and released, it's just subject to speculation. And I just did a couple of cursory searches on the Post and the Times, and can't find any discussion of that part of the what was going on at Abu Ghraib.
Well, Abu Ghraib is really kind of a lawless enclave, very much like the retired federal judge who was arguing in the Supreme Court on behalf of the Guantanamo prisoners a few weeks ago described Guantanamo. And it was not clear who was in charge. There was a lot of chaos there. This came through certainly in General Taguba's report. And I believe I have also seen a report from a female. I can't remember where I read it. I think it might have been in the Washington Post, but I'm not sure. Female soldier at that prison who said that was talking about two Iraqi prisoners were shot as they were escaping. That's two less. I'm glad that happened. Two less that I have to worry about. So it may be that they were given opportunities to run out the door, and then they were shot, for sport or to send a message to other prisoners. And it's very unclear, and that's why hopefully these criminal investigations will uncover much more information about what really did go on there. Although Major General Taguba's report is very thorough, but I think that since all of this has become public, it will empower many more people to come forward and talk about what really happened.
Let's go to another caller, Gibson City, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I hope that I'll be able to make a brief comment and then hang up and listen to the comments of your guest upon my comment.
Mm-hmm.
At this moment, I'm not concerned about the culpability of the soldiers in the prison or the possible culpability of the leadership group in Washington, D.C. At this moment, I'm thinking about the attitude of the general public people who sit around chatting in the coffee shops. And it seems to me that so many of them take the attitude, we are Americans, and therefore we're entitled to dominate the world. We are American macho men, and therefore we are entitled to go brutally forward and trample everybody else under our feet. We are Americans, and therefore the laws mean nothing to us. We will do as we please in any case, and we don't care about the United Nations or any laws or anything like that. Do you see any of that attitude in the general public? And if so, do you think it will influence what's happening? I'll hang up now and listen to you.
All right.
Well, thank you for that comment. I believe that the overwhelming majority of American people are compassionate people, and the people that I have spoken to and emailed with and had communication with are just they're in pain about what has happened and what they've seen and what has been done in their name. That's not to say that there are not people who do have the type of mentality that the caller is describing. But I venture to say that to the extent that people do feel that way, that comes from the top. That comes from the cowboy in the White House who says, bring 'em on, who says, mission accomplished, who gets into a flight suit and lands on an aircraft carrier and declares victory, and then proceeds to send our troops to get killed and to be killed for more than a year later, who devastates the infrastructure of another country. And I really have to think that this particular humiliation and torture and inhuman treatment of these prisoners would not have happened if they were white. I think there's a lot of racism involved here, and I think there's a dehumanizing of other people who are not white. But I do, and I'm not trying to relieve people of the responsibility who do feel that way. But I think that the example that is set by our leadership is so destructive that it really encourages that type of behavior. When you say they're either with us or against us. And even the invasion of Afghanistan, and I know that now with Iraq, people look back and say, well, that the invasion of Afghanistan was justified, but maybe Iraq wasn't. The country of Afghanistan, the government of Afghanistan, never attacked us, never threatened us. Most of those hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. And when Bush said in his macho way that either they turn over Osama bin Laden to us, the Taliban turn over Osama bin Laden, or we're going to go get them, let's turn the tables around. Let's say that after the Shah of Iran, who was a vicious tyrant who tortured and murdered his people for 25 years, who was put in by the U.S. in the first place after the CIA overthrew a democratically elected government, but the Shah was overthrown by a revolution, and the Shah, who was ill, came to the United States and was being harbored by the United States and was in New York receiving medical treatment for his cancer. What if the new Iranian government had said to Bush, either you turn over the Shah to us, or we are going to invade and bomb your country? Countries just don't have a right to do that. They really don't. And I think that that mentality, to the extent it exists in any people in this country, comes from the top. And that's why I think that really the only way to stop the deaths and the wounding, and there have been more than 11,000 of our own soldiers wounded, we never hear about that, the way to stop more death, more killing, more destruction of both Americans and Iraqis is for a regime change to take place in the White House, because only then, and I don't have illusions that Kerry is going to be able to solve the problem immediately, but that would change the dynamic to the extent that perhaps Kerry could go to those Ayatollahs who have so much support among the Iraqi people and negotiate a peaceful settlement, because I don't see any other way. Certainly, ideally, the U.S. should pull out, the U.N. should totally take over, and the U.S. should pay restitution for what it did to that country. But that's not going to happen on Bush's watch. So I think that that's really the only way to stop the killing and stop the carnage.
We're very close to being at the end of the time. I have a number of other callers, and we're not going to get them all, but let me try and get one more at least in Chicago, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm not going to ask my question because it's such short time, so I'm just going to give you some information about, you said that racism was a factor. It's out of the Pacific News Service, and it's in the May 14th issue of National Catholic Reporter. They say that the South African Foreign Ministry estimates that 1,500 South Africans are among the mercenaries there, the people who bolstered their application forms with their experience under apartheid regime. And so I think that the use of dogs in some of these activities really reflects, I believe, the influence of these South African mercenaries, and the fact that this, they're trying to avoid looking at what they love to call civilian contractors, really says to me that we're not going to get to the root of the problem.
Well, do you have, Professor Cohen, you have about a 30-second comment that we can end on?
Well, I appreciate that, and I didn't know that. And I agree that this whole issue of mercenaries, and I don't call them civilian contractors, I call them mercenaries, is a problem. We had a demonstration last week in San Diego at the Titan Corporation, which is one of the two corporations that send, they actually send translators. And they're saying, well, we don't really have any liability. That was a subcontractor. They just translated. Well, if you're a translator and you're asked to translate into Arabic threats to commit torture or murder, then you're also complicit. And it is true that these mercenaries, you know, interestingly, the daily shelling of Fallujah and the killing of 70% of the people who have been killed by the U.S. are civilians, was in retaliation, was in revenge for the killing of and horrible mutilation of four mercenaries. And I wonder why they had such anger against those people. I mean, there's no excuse for what they did to those four people, but those were not U.S. soldiers. Those were mercenaries. And Halliburton and Bechtel and all those corporations are making billions and billions of dollars off of this war, off of this this horrible death and destruction.
We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much, Professor Cohen, for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, David.
Our guest, Marjorie Cohen, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, San Diego, where she teaches courses in international human rights law. She is executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild and co-chair of the Guild's International Committee. She was recently elected the U.S. representative to the American Association of Jurists. The broadcast today made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL Saturday, May 15th from 1 to 4 at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines will be featured along with a silent auction, music by the Broke Artists of Champaign-Urbana. Tickets available at the door or in advance at the Corkscrew. For more information, call 337-7704. The broadcast also made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from Russia, South America, Mexico, and Britain, and featuring food tastings every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. We're going to take a break. We'll have news at 1 minute past the hour, then more of Focus, so please stay tuned.
Thank you very much, Dave. Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. Let's look at the